Okay, so we're past Thanksgiving, which sort of means it's starting to move toward the end part of the retreat. As we do move toward the end of the retreat, I think it's important to be attentive. It ain't over yet, you know. but to be attentive, because a theme that I plugged in right from the beginning is this gradual path, gradual training, and to recognize this gradual approach to our practice, where we're very alert, attentive, and not rushing. So this is sort of a time to kind of gather in toward the end of the retreat, rather than letting things disperse. You know, sort of, oh, it's getting toward the end. It starts going out. It's sort of, no, it's getting toward the end. Pulling it in. One of the images that comes to mind that Ajahn Chah used in approaching practice of the, because he uses an image from that very common in village life in northeast of Thailand, and it's of the farmers going out and fishing, and so throwing these nets for fishing, and it's just you throw it out, and then you just have to really, one, you have to be careful when you throw it out, so you don't just sort of scrunch it up in a ball and throw it in the water. It's sort of you throw it out so that there's an even sort of spread of the net, and then you start pulling it back in gradually and slowly, so that you're actually going to catch something. If you pull it, so you just sort of throw it out and then go for coffee and come back later, nothing much is going to happen. But then, if you throw it out and you start I'll try to get this done as quick as I can, so you bring it in as quick as you can, just scare all the fish away. So that just throwing it out and gradually pulling it in. So similarly with our practice over this retreat and over practice in general, but particularly during this retreat time, we've had the opportunity to kind of cast a net of mindfulness over our experience and to be able to learn and understand it more clearly and to be able to experience more clarity and more discernment. So just keeping up that kind of patience and consistency. And of course it's dependent on practicing in an appropriate way. But the Buddha has given us all the tools, so that's to be, delighted in, and to be very grateful for. In the sense, I've got the tool. The Buddha has given us this path. There's an image that the Buddha gives of the application of the path. In terms of, the right application of the Eightfold Path, wrong application of the Eightfold Path, it gives the image of a wrong application of Eightfold Path. It's as if somebody were wanting oil, in need of oil, and went in search of oil, got a bunch of gravel and put it into a container, sort of pressed it, pounded it, sprinkled water on it now and again, and chances of getting oil are pretty slim. So it's just sort of, and the Buddha said it's like that. It's the wrong constituents of the equation, and the same with the wrong view, wrong thought, wrong speech, wrong action, all the way to wrong concentration. It's not gonna bring results. But he said on the opposite side, same way of somebody wanting oil, in need of oil, in search of oil, and went and got a whole bunch of sesame seeds, put it into a container, pressed it, pounded it, sprinkled water now and again, and squeezed it out. Then you're gonna get oil. You end up with nice sesame oil. So, and it's because it's the right constituents, right way of going about it. In the same way with needing peace, in want of peace, in search of peace, and we have this Eightfold Path that we can apply in an appropriate manner, and yeah, it'll bring results. So to be having that kind of confidence, but then also the patience to keep working with it in a measured and consistent manner, recognizing that yeah, this is a gradual path, and sometimes it takes time. And sometimes in the suttas we read the accounts of somebody receiving teachings, and they receive teachings, and then they become immediately enlightened, or they receive teachings, and then they go off in the forest, and it sounds like the next day they're enlightened. That's really frustrating. What about me? In the language, sometimes it's just not specified. There's a one sutta where the monk gains faith, ordains, receives teachings, and then they say, in no long time, he sort of penetrated the Dhamma, and is it. Then it explains later, and sort of, in no long time was 15 years. So these things are relative, and recognize that it's even in the Buddha's time, it wasn't even having the Buddha there, and it wasn't as if he just sort of tapped you on the head and boom, you're enlightened. And you had to do the work, and you had to put the time and effort in. So that as we do cultivate this path, pull the practice and the training together, then to be patient, be consistent, be steady in one's practice. As we continue our, say, meditation, developing of our, say, sitting practice, walking practice, cultivation of our formal side of the development of the mind, this I've been bringing up the Anapanasati Sutta from time to time to give a structure for the meditation. And of course there are 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing grouped into four groups of four, and according to the following the structure of the four foundations of mindfulness, so that the section on the mind begins, I will train thus, experiencing the mind I breathe in, experiencing the mind I breathe out, or sensitive to the mind I breathe in, sensitive to the mind I breathe out. So, paying attention, in mind in this sense is not it's not California therapy. It's paying attention to the content of the mind. What is the content of the mind? Being able to recognize, oh, this is a mind with greed or desire, and this is a mind without greed or without desire. And just recognizing that, well, this is a mind with aversion, ill will. This is a mind without aversion, ill will. This is a mind with delusion. This is a mind without delusion. So this is breathing in, breathing out. Just be alert and attentive to, well, what's the actual content of the mind? I think it's really important to stress the fact that the Buddha is pointing to both sides of the equation. I'm sure the vast majority of us don't give much attention to that when we're sitting and meditating, saying, oh, there's no greed or desire here. No, there's no ill will, no irritation, no aversion. These are, we tend to sort of, oh my God, there's greed again. There's my angry mind. Oh God. And of course, then we identify with it, and it becomes quite solid and entrenched. But the reality is, these mind states, this content of the mind, kind of drifts in and out, kind of like say a Bayagiri in the wintertime. We're in a valley, and you see through the winter, then kind of clouds come in and out, and the mists, and they come in and out through the valley, and they're like through the summer, it's sort of just clear blue skies almost all the time, but in the wintertime, it's these mists and clouds, they just come through. Sometimes they're lower, sometimes they're higher. Sometimes they hang in a particular area of the valley, and some particular area of the forest, and they move. And so that's it's kind of like the moods in our mind. They move in, they move out. Depends on what way the wind is blowing. And to be attentive, oh, this is a mind with greed. Oh, this is a mind without greed. This is a mind, this is its content, this is it. And it's just sort of, it's not about me, it's not about my mind, it's about, oh, the mind is like this, and the mind is like that. This is what a mind with delusion is like. That's its appearance. So it's like really being able to step back and walk, and with that rhythm, almost like a pulse beat of the breath coming in, the breath going out. You've got this anchor, you've got this this foundation from which one can be attentive and alert to the ways that the mind is manifesting. Or they're just being attentive. Oh, this is a constricted mind. I'm feeling, you know, there's a constriction there. Or this is an expanded mind. The mind is so expansive, and this is a restless mind. This is a steady mind, a calm mind. And so just being able to say, this is what the mind is like as I breathe in, as I breathe out. I mean, oftentimes what happens is, of course, the content, something triggers trains of thought, trains of emotion, and then we get caught up in that. But this is an opportunity to come back to just the fundamental content, mood of the mind, and then one doesn't have to analyze it. One doesn't have to react to it in any way. That being present with the breath and having the awareness that it's like this. It has an effect. There's so much compulsiveness in our doing sometimes, like trying to fix the mind, trying to image from an old Western movie. You know, so ride and gallop in on our horses, head them off with the pass, you know? and we just get busy. Just stepping back, breathing in, breathing out. The mind is like this. And that in itself has a huge calming effect, but it's also when starting to gain knowledge of the mind. And that, of course, that in this first step, that's what one is doing, was just being alert, being present, being attentive to the content and the sensitive to the mind, experiencing the mind. The mind is like this. That's in the next step that the Buddha encourages doing something about it. But his doing, is prescribed in the sense of saying, gladdening the mind, I breathe in, gladdening the mind, I breathe out, or satisfying the mind, I breathe in, delighting the mind, I breathe in. These are the Pali word is abhipamodayang, and it's pamoja is like a delight or well-being, and then abhi is like an amplifier. So it's like, yeah, to gladden the mind, delight it, satisfy it. So in order to, say, gladden, to brighten the mind, what is it that gladdens the mind in meditation, in our spiritual search? You know, we've got all sorts of strategies that we've relied on to make ourselves feel good. Netflix, getting up from meditation and going to the refrigerator gladdens the mind, but that's but that's not, it's not really a helpful solution, or no, it's not a long-term solution. and not even a very stable one. So that of course, when the Buddha is saying to gladden the mind, the lifting up of an object of mind, that the mind feels some kind of delight, satisfaction, inspiration, so that sometimes with different meditations will affect us in different ways, and it's something to pay attention to. There's a set of teachings that the Buddha gives that are called protective meditations, and the anulakkhana gammatthana. They're protective meditations, but they're protective in the sense that they form a really wholesome base for the mind. So the first one is Buddha Anusati, the recollection of the Buddha. So that recollecting, that it could be in a discursive way, just recollecting the qualities of the Buddha, recollecting the tremendous debt of gratitude that we have to the Buddha for being willing to teach and lay out a teaching that is consistent and has held together, I mean, for over 2,500 years, and that's pretty amazing, really, and that we have access to those teachings, and that. And also that one that he was, because his first inclination was, oh, this is just too subtle. Nobody's going to understand this. It's just going to be tiring and vexing to have to try to teach people. And he was willing to say, okay, I'll just not bother. But then there was that arising of compassion, and he was pretty tireless for 45 years to keep teaching, keep explaining, keep clarifying the teaching and the training. And we reflect on that. It has a real powerful effect on the mind. Or doesn't mind anyway, and it really gladdens the mind. That's a discursive meditation in terms of Buddha Anusati. Sometimes some people don't respond that well to discursive meditation, but they're more visual. So then that's where having, say, like the use of Buddha images can be quite helpful. Because they're visual images that we can bring to mind that help us recollect the qualities of the Buddha. Just the archetype and the archetypal image for a Buddha is those qualities of peace, serenity, awake, in the sense that if you look at a Buddha image, most Buddha images will the eyes will be slightly open, and they're, I don't know about this one, they usually be slightly open as a symbol of that the Buddha is awake. He's not drifted off in some other world somewhere. He's present. He's awake. He has awakened. And so it's a reminder of that quality. Also, the upright posture of the Buddha. I mean, nobody makes Buddha images. Slumped over. As Buddha's awake and present, and bringing that image to mind is really helpful. Like we have, because we're building a new hall at Abhayagiri, and we have a Buddha image there, and it's carved out of sandstone, so it's an unforgiving medium. Now, there was a monk in Thailand who volunteered to help oversee the carving of the image, and fortunately for us, he's both has a refined aesthetic sense. And he's a bit of a perfectionist. But the image was carved three times. So in order that till he was satisfied that this was an image that was worth being taken to America. And everybody's got views and opinions about different images, but I think it's beautiful. It captured certain feelings. He was sending me pictures of the second image, and of course, in a picture you only get sort of you're looking at it through the lens of a picture. You're not really able to step back, and each aspect was really beautiful. And it wasn't until he pointed it out that I could see, what he was saying. It just doesn't quite fit together. You know, the shoulders were just a bit too slumpy. You know, and it didn't have quite that same presence that he wanted the image to have, and the new one does. And it was really close. And he was really hesitating, and fortunately, there was a layperson who knew him well, and said, you know, if you're not satisfied with this image, I think it's quite beautiful, and I'll purchase it, and then you can start again. Which is, he said, oh, thank you, because it was it's quite close, but it didn't quite. So that Buddha images have that sense of a presence and a mixture of both a quality of maybe like Bhajan Chah was asked one time, what is it? What quality do you feel you have that made you able to? You're different than others, or that really brought you to a place of liberation, or able to do that. And he said, I'm really not that special or different than anybody, but maybe if we point to a quality, it was that I dared to do it. I dared to put myself on the line. And that's a quality that one we have to embody, but also let's say as a Buddha image or as a reminder that for the Buddha being someone who similarly had the courage to be present with greed, hate, and illusion, and realize that can be relinquished. And it's that simple willingness to, I'm just going to do it. So that gladdening the mind, just reflecting on the different qualities, having images that help to remind us, finding ways, and of course there's many, many ways of doing that, and sort of Buddhist history is filled with skillful means that serve to support that aspiration for understanding peace and freedom. That being being willing to experiment and see, well, what gladdens the mind, what satisfies the mind. The say loving kindness is a quality that gladdens the mind. Bringing up that quality of care, that wish for well-being, that may I abide in well-being, not just as a chant, but as something that you bring into the heart. May I abide in well-being. What would that mean? And what would that feel like? And what qualities can I rely on to establish well-being? It's a real... that's a translation that we use in our chanting. The Pali is quite simple. Say, Ahang Sukhito Homi. And Ajahn Jeff translates it very simply. Say, may I be happy. And it's sort of right there. May I be happy. And to lift up that aspiration, that wish, that caring attention. May I be happy. May I not get overwhelmed by fear or difficulty or problems. It's just as the... because the nature of life is that's all there. May I be happy. May I abide in well-being. And, of course, as we nurture that and solidify that and steep ourselves in that, the heart really grows. It's able to expand and contain others. And so that wishing of well-being, of happiness for others. And we begin with people that are close to us, but we keep being willing to expand that out. And it's important not to do that too quickly, because again, the mind is already prone to dispersal. It's looking for an object to distract itself. So that keep paying attention to the solid base of loving kindness, well-being, well-wishing, of happiness, that there is a kind of a gladdened, satisfied mind that is the ground. Breathing in, gladdening the mind, breathing out, gladdening the mind. And that's you using an object, say, like loving kindness as a base. And it extends out to more and more beings until there's an expansive quality. It's like in the Buddha's words on loving kindness, that's a simple phrase, that wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. It's a beautiful aspiration that we can keep reminding ourselves of that, and then lifting up the mind to that quality. And it gladdens the mind. Now, in terms of gladdening the mind and satisfying the mind, sometimes it's counterintuitive, but say something like, and these are part of the these four protective meditations, as say asubha practices. It's reflecting on the 32 parts of the body, unattractive nature of the body. And you know, I say it might be counterintuitive, but sometimes, you know, what... See, when we lift up the... Especially, you know, our mind can be so habituated to either concern for the body, concern for body appearance, concern for the health of the body, concern for all of these things. And then when you lift up, like a Asubha Kamatan, you start looking, oh, this is the body. It's always been like this. It's always been hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. You know, we might have had a few less hairs when we were first born, but of course it's sort of moving the other but it's hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. It's just it's a basic human condition. The flesh, sinews, bones, internal organs, different fluids and whatnot that wash about inside our bodies. Those are, it's just part of having a human body. And bodies are like this. And it's like, oh, we're willing to pick it up in a way that I say, oh, that, there isn't really any kind of need to get excited, obsessed, worried, attracted, averse. It's just a body. And then that cools the mind, and just this sort of feeling of gladdening the mind, because we're not either obsessing how young, how old, how tall, how short, how attractive, how unattractive, how male, how female. It's just sort of, they're just bodies. And this is wonderful opportunity to put it down as a, because we identify so much with the body, and being able to not be driven by that, not be pulled around by that, it's incredible relief, and the mind brightens. It's just glad and delighted the opportunity to just be with Dhamma. Just be with the way things are. Just be with people as they are. Even when we see somebody, you know, we immediately go to sort of the labels: male, female, young, old. What's their name? You know, what was their name anyway? This problem as you get older. I used to be able to remember names really well, all we ever see of anybody, really, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin, and that's not a dismiss of it, but it's a way of shifting our attention from the things that trip us up and complicate the mind, and realize, oh, we can create so much more space in our hearts, in our minds, by viewing from a different perspective, and then the heart becomes really gladdened, and gladdening the mind, I breathe in. Gladdening the mind, I breathe out. And similarly, the contemplation of the last one of the protective meditations is Marnasati. Contemplation of death, and it has a similar effect, in the sense of it shifts perspective and makes things more immediate or more, you know, we tend to, you know, get less obsessed about something, some person, some event, when we are willing to look at, no, death is really present. We're carrying death with us. There's a really interesting, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was asked a question about, you know, about his practice. You know, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something like, what's the basis of your practice, or what is it that you actually practice? You know, what is the purpose of your practice, or something like that? And but His Holiness is saying, "Oh, I'm preparing to die." And sort of for all of, you know, the incredible purity, presence, compassion that he embodies, and that he is, and that he's been trained I don't know how many sort of schools of philosophy and dialectics and incredible knowledge, and of course his own life is a testament to his commitment and his wisdom, deep wisdom. But then, you know, when it really comes down to it, you know, what is it that for in his own perspective, you know, what is it that he's doing? He said, "I'm preparing to die," and that's a wonderful thing, to me, that's really inspiring, gladdening. It's that simple. All of the knowledge and all of the practices and whatnot are all the support, and with the kind of that seed kernel of, oh yeah, death is a that is a certainty. Of all the things that we can be certain of, that sort of is foremost, and know, to be able to live our life, make decisions, make choices with that sense of, oh yeah, when it comes to the moment of death, you know, did I waste time? Did I waste an opportunity? It's more like, oh, and yet it's really present. Well, it becomes a lot more clear. Oh yeah, this is a good thing to do. I don't need to obsess over this. And it really gladdens the mind, brightens the mind. So I think these, in terms of our practice and during the retreat, again, just this a reiteration of the viewing our practice from the perspective of a gradual path, a gradual training, and to be gathering it in, but not making it a burden, because sometimes we oppress ourselves by trying too hard, setting a standard that is unrealistic. And to pay attention to the things that, well, what is it that really uplifts the mind, gladdens the mind, delights it, so that practice becomes something that is really enjoyable, and even if it's sometimes difficult, but there's still, one can still delight in the essence of it, the benefit of it, the goal that we're setting for ourselves. So I'll offer that for reflection this morning, and we can continue. It's interesting, sometimes these and Dhamma talks have their own life. That isn't what I was going to talk about this morning. I had kind of, you know, I had a kind of an idea. I said, well, maybe I'll talk about this. And it didn't. It just had its own life.